Today is September 13th, 1974, a Friday. The following interview is with Dean Burch, B-U-R-C-H, a counselor to the president. The interview will take place in Mr. Burch's office in the second floor of the West Wing of the White House. Terry Good will conduct the interview.
To start with, I understand that you came over here on March 8th of 1974.
Yes.
Prior to that, you were with the Federal Communication Commission.
Yes, I was chairman of the Federal Communications.
The staff that you have over here now, were they all with you over there?
Did
you
bring them? Yes, brought them all intact.
Very briefly, is the structure of this office broken down with specific responsibilities?
No, it's not. Jennifer Fitzgerald is my secretary, and she functions as a kind of an executive secretary or a private secretary. And Kay Nuhan works for Chuck. And we're small enough that we don't really have to subdivide very much. Chuck and I work closely, almost interchangeably. But by and large, anything that is written will ultimately come out of his typewriter. He's a marvelous wordsmith and a remarkable punctuator and things like that. So if I have to do a memo, I'll draft out something and then he'll kind of polish it up. He'll do speeches. He can do anything. He's a terribly able and bright guy. But we did not subdivide beyond that.
Could I ask how you were recruited to come over here, Mr. Burch,
yeah.
And for what reason?
I had planned to leave the FCC for some time. In fact, originally I had planned to leave in the winter, the January through March period of 1973. I wanted to leave for primarily personal reasons, in the sense that my children were getting older, I had more financial requirements and I couldn't meet them in the government salary. Secondly, that in a job like chairman of the FCC, there's kind of a point of diminishing returns, beyond which you're really better off getting into something else. You kind of spend all of your assets and then it's time to move on. So I had been in touch with Tom Whitehead at OTP explaining that, and with Peter Flanagan, who was really the guy who recruited me for the FCC originally. But Peter, in the meantime, had been reassigned so that he didn't have the regulatory agencies. And actually, during that period, there was sort of a gap in the White House staff. We didn't really have anybody that seemed to be responsible for or care about the regulatory agencies. So I didn't quite know who to deal with. And this situation continued until October and November of 1973. I was sort of on tenterhooks. But the main reason I didn't press to leave in January through March is, you may recall, that was the period of the Thousand Knives when everybody had to submit their resignations. And as a consequence, nobody wanted to leave voluntarily during that period. So I stuck around. Then about October of that year, I started renewing my pursuit of departure, and this involved finding a successor and quite a complicated procedure. I worked with Whitehead, I worked with Weimer, Dave Weimer, at the personnel shop. And coincidentally, during that same period, we had a vacancy on the FCC, and a guy named, I was pushing for a fellow named Robinson, Glenn Robinson, who was a terribly capable guy, and parentheses is now on the FCC in print. The political candidate was a guy named Jim Quello, who got the appointment over my protest particularly, but just simply because I didn't think of the two, he was the better qualified. But he was from Michigan, and was being supported by the then minority leader, then vice president, and Mel Laird. And so in early, well, in late February of 1974, I had written two memoranda to Al Haig, who had become chief of staff, almost pleading that I had to get going. Would somebody pay some attention to these screams coming from the FCC? And I was sorely tempted to send him a telegram, the help, I'm being held captive at the FCC, but I did not. And he called me over and asked me to come to the White House. And I'd never met Haig, except I played tennis with him one time. And he and I had been in the Army at the same place, at or near the same time, but I didn't know him. I knew his wife, but I didn't know him. And so he had called me in, and after the usual coffee and whatnot, he said, I've got some good news and some bad news. And the bad news was that my candidate for the FCC didn't make it. And the other, he said, the president would like me to come to the White House rather than leave government as a counselor, cabinet rank, and whatnot. Well, this came out of the blue. I had no idea why or how this thing happened. And I still don't, frankly. If you find out, I wish you'd let me know, because there are a number of theories. One theory, and the one I prefer, is that perhaps the president thought I would be useful on the merits. The other theory is that because of the very difficult situation he was in, he was trying to cover his Arizona bases with Goldwater and Rhodes. But that seems a bit overly naive to me, because anybody who knows either of those people, and President Nixon certainly did, knows that, you know, they are going to do whatever they are going to do. But in any event, I went to Key Biscayne to meet with the president, and kind of an interesting trip in the sense that I was called almost secretively and told to go to Key Biscayne. I'd be met with a car, taken to the president's house, and have this interview. And I got to Miami. There was no car, so I finally got a cab, and I got to the compound, and unfortunately didn't know where the compound was, so I asked a gas station operator, who told me, but he said, the president isn't there. I said, how do you know? He says, I just saw him driving the other way. Nobody at the compound knew I was coming, and nobody except Haig, but he hadn't told anybody, so it was a kind of a grand snafu, and I finally did get in to see the president, and kind of fascinating. I'd never seen the Key Biscayne compound before. And somehow, I guess like everyone else, I'd thought of it as all sort of pomp and circumstance and beauty and whatnot. And the houses are really very tacky houses, as far as I can tell. They're kind of typical Florida construction, cardboard with a little eighth-inch stucco on the outside. And it was a very hot day, even though it was February or March, I guess. But it was colder than hell in the president's den, and he had the fireplace going, which I found, it's the first time I'd ever actually seen that situation. We chatted for about an hour and a half, Haig and the president and I. Bryce Harlow had also been there, but he wasn't in the meeting. And then I went back to the hotel, I don't remember the name of the hotel, and we spent the better part of the afternoon, from perhaps 2 o'clock till 7 o'clock that night, trying to work out a press release to announce all this, which was announced the next morning from Key Biscayne by, I guess, Jerry Warner, Ron Ziegler, I don't remember which. In the meantime, I was heading for Arizona. And my wife and I had planned a vacation for a long time at Phoenix and went ahead and did it. So this was February, because I remember that we were in John Gardner's tennis ranch in the last week of February. And then came back, spent a week. The original understanding was that I was to leave the FCC on the 14th of March. But Haig wanted to speed it up, and after it had been announced that I was leaving, I found that I was sort of a eunuch anyhow, so it was just as well to get it over with. And I came over and The original understanding was that I would work on special projects, that I would be the president's advisor on regulatory matters, administrative law, judicial appointments, and politics generally. Of course, during that period, in March of 1974, all that was well and good, but the only game in town was Watergate. And within a matter of literally days, I found myself spending all day, every day, on Watergate matters. And by that, I mean contacting congressmen, senators, reporters, giving news interviews, the usual sort of thing, and trying to strategize the president's defense. And I met very frequently with Haig and Timmons, Ron Ziegler, Fred Bizard, what the hell is the president's counsel's name? From Boston.
St. Clair,
Jim St. Clair. To a lesser extent, with Pat Buchanan, Dave Gergen. And out of that, ultimately, I sort of ended up heading up a 9 o'clock group. We met at 9 o'clock in my office, which was sort of the interface between the lower and middle staff and Haig, with me being the liaison. We would review the various news clippings for the day. Ken Clausen was in on all of them. We would then attempt to assess what was going on and make recommendations as to what should be done, by whom, when, and how. And this was, of course, a frustrating period because none of this was playing very well, and I didn't have any particular knowledge about the president's involvement that you couldn't have ascertained from reading the newspaper. Except for the fact that I had read the March 21st tape shortly after I got here. And so, the question which I think will perhaps be argued for a long time was whether or not the president should have released publicly the tapes that he did in response to the Judiciary Committee subpoena. And I think in fairness to those who participated in the decision, including the president, that the decision was dictated, at least in my mind, by the fact that the March 21st tape, which was by far the worst tape of the whole bunch, was already in the possession of the Judiciary Committee and was in the possession of Mr. Jaworski. And as a consequence, most of us felt that if that were set out as a cameo and everybody just sat there and looked at it and didn't know what came before or after, it was devastating. It was still devastating, but less so if it were surrounded by a lot of other material. Of course, we knew nothing about the June 23rd tape at that time. In addition to that, I did involve myself as best I could in regulatory matters. Recommendations as far as commissioners and various regulatory commissions. Firing Alvin Arnett from the OEO, that sort of thing sort of seemed to fall my lot. And I traveled a good bit with the president. We had only really three political appearances during that time, which was originally why I came over here. One was in the 8th District in Michigan, which was the Saginaw, Flint, Bad Axe, Thumb area of Michigan, which was sort of an artistic success but a political failure in the sense that our candidate, who was 10 points behind when we went up there, lost by about four points. So it's arguable whether the president helped. I think he probably did. Then we went to Mississippi and did an affair. Actually, it was billed as a non-political affair, but it had a lot of political overtones. And then we did an affair in Phoenix, Arizona, which by this time was more for the president's benefit than it was for anyone else. It was not, I don't think it either helped or hurt, Rhodes or Goldwater or Governor Williams in Arizona. But subliminally, the purpose was to prove that the president had popularity, could do things with crowds, as indeed he could. And it was, from that respect, a very successful campaign. And from there, we went to Spokane, I guess it was, to open the fair up there. And then flew back to Washington with a stop along the way. And frankly, I don't remember where the stop was now. I just can't remember. And my relationships with the president were always, I would say, rather cool and proper. I never felt that I was an intimate of his. A couple of times on the airplane, he sort of let his hair down a little bit, but not much. And had a great deal of sympathy for the position in which he found himself, particularly the last weeks of the administration. And it became clear once the June 23rd tape was released that there was no way to end this except his leaving. And then it was just a matter of style and grace from then on. But particularly the last evening, Thursday, the 8th of August, when he actually resigned, was a really a heart-rending experience to watch power slip through somebody's fingers so rapidly and nothing you could do about it. Absolutely an irreversible trend. The evening of August 8th, he had three engagements that I know about, and I suspect others that I don't know about, well, perhaps with Henry Kissinger or Haig or whatever. But at 6:30 that evening, he met with Senator Scott, Senator Mansfield, the Speaker, Jim Eastland, Johnny Rhodes, in the EOB office to say goodbye and inform them of the decision that would be announced at 9 o'clock that evening. I don't think anybody had any illusions about what it was going to be, but it was a sort of a right thing to do. And then at 8 o'clock, he met in the cabinet room with about 40 members of Congress, 40-plus members of Congress, who can be characterized only as sort of friends of the family. They were not necessarily Republican, they were not necessarily Southern, they were not necessarily anything. They were just a gathering of people that had always been friendly to President Nixon throughout his political career. And it was perhaps the most singularly tragic thing that I've ever attended. Lasted about 25 minutes, I guess, and the president broke down toward the end, started crying, said, the last words he said were, "I hope I haven't let any of you down," got up, really almost lurched from the room. He wasn't walking in a normal way, and then everybody in the room broke down, and I mean literally everybody in the room was crying. This is from Barry Goldwater to John Tower to Bob Michael to Les Ahrens to Joe Wagner, you name them. They were all big grown men in tears. Bill Timmons and I guess, were leading the parade. The only one that perhaps was an exception was Haig, but I guess he'd done his crying before and he'd gotten it out of his system. The remarkable thing was this meeting ended at perhaps 8:35. And 25 minutes later, the president went on television looking pretty good and certainly in control of himself.
You've covered a number of the things that I mentioned I would like to ask you about.
Insofar as a routine day for you, simply for the record, would you?
Well, there weren't any routine days in those days, but the routine started with a 8:30 breakfast meeting, or not a breakfast meeting, the 8:30 senior staff. That is now the 8 o'clock senior staff meeting. Prior to that time, I would generally have breakfast in the mess and would normally have breakfast with Bizard and St. Clair and Clausen and a number of others, and that would be the first time we had a chance to more or less assess what had happened previous evening. We did the 8:30 meeting, then we'd come up to my office and do the 9 o'clock meeting, the so-called Watergate meeting. And that consisted of Dave Gergen, Ken Kachigian, Pat Buchanan, Bill Baruti, Ken Clausen, Bill Timmons, Chuck Lichtenstein, Dick Moore, Lynn Garment at times. And this was not a particularly structured meeting. Bruce Whalehan was in this. We didn't keep any agenda or even any notes of the meetings. Not that there was anything proper, but it was just the kind of thing that improper. But it was just the kind of thing that the way the White House was in those times, you assumed that anything you wrote down would be in somebody's hands within 8 hours, and it just wasn't a worthwhile endeavor. Because some of it did go to the motives of some of those who were beating their breasts the loudest. I would generally then meet at 10 o'clock or mid-morning, depending on the day's activities, with Haig, St. Clair, Bizard, Timmons, Clausen, and we would then determine pretty much what was going to happen on that particular day in terms of public relations and or press and or presidential activities that related to Watergate. But the real Watergate story can probably only be told by Haig. He's really the only one who knows what all was going on, because all the rest of us were seeing the picture rather dimly, and we were only seeing our part of it. He saw it all, I would guess. And I hope someday maybe he'll elaborate on some of the things that he had to do during that period. And when the president was traveling to the Mideast, to Russia during that period, I became more or less Haig's stand-in, in the sense that he and I communicated two or three times a day by phone, and I'd carry out what I could. But as a practical matter, there wasn't a hell of a lot going on when the president and all that group was out of town, and there weren't anything other than routine and ordinary matters that were taken care of. And so it wasn't quite as onerous a task as it might have sounded. There were no appointments of any consequence. And the usual couriers and whatnot took care of signing things, but not a hell of a lot went on while they were out of town that was terribly important. And of course, they were out of town an awful lot during that period that I was here. They had the Mideast trip, the Russian trip, a number of trips to Key Biscayne, at least two trips to San Clemente that I remember. So there was a lot of traveling.
Your afternoons, were they less structured than the morning?
No, they were really kind of repeats of the morning. We'd usually get together again with Haig either, often the afternoon meeting might be as late as 7 or 7:30 at night. Depending on what was going on, we might well reconvene the 9 o'clock group for a 3 o'clock meeting. But I guess you would say that the afternoon was a little less regimented than the morning. And the afternoon was also when I tended to do what non-Watergate business was going on. I'd get transacted at that time.
Would there be any way to gauge the amount of time you might have spent in telephone contacts during the course of the day, Mr. Bird?
No, but I would guess it would be a large percentage of the day, like 25, between 25 and as much as 50% of the day would be spent placing or receiving telephone calls.
Based on what you've told me, it would appear as though you had very little time for face-to-face meetings with people other than those within the White House.
Yes, unfortunately that's true. I did go up on the Hill a number of times during the period for some special types of meetings where we'd take St. Clair up to brief someone, or Bizard, or meet with the Republican leadership, or something of that nature. Timmons and I worked together rather closely. And my role tended to overlap with Timmons, and it was unavoidable, and I think he and I understood it perfectly well, but there was a certain amount, I suspect, of distrust on his part when I first came over here as to whether I was going to get into his area. But I think we worked that out. I had no desire to be the legislative liaison, but of necessity, when you were dealing with this thing, you tend to have to meet people. And Rhodes, and of course Goldwater, and the then vice president were three of the people that I was charged with keeping up on, and Hugh Scott. Those were the four that I kept up on almost a daily basis. Take their temperature, see what they're doing, advising them what was going on, and candidly listening to an awful lot of bitching about the tapes, about the disclosure of them or the non-disclosure of them, or the tone or whatnot of letters and statements.
To what degree would your office files or the White House files reflect your activities during this
period
of time?
Very little. Very little.
That's what I suspected, but at least we've got it for the record. Yeah.
I would imagine that my files would look like I hadn't done anything while I was here except write a few form letters and
recommend a few appointments.
Recommend a few appointments and sign off on a lot of the paperwork that floats around a place like this. But the bulk of what I did was done on yellow pads and thrown away, and telephones, calls, conferring with no... And you know, this sounds much more diabolic than it really is. The fact that I don't have extensive records of this period, it's just that it wasn't appropriate. I wasn't going to write a book, so I didn't keep a diary or anything. I kind of wish I had, in a way. And there just was no point in putting all this on paper. It just took too long. Would have taken too long.
Well, your situation, I don't believe, is unique, at least for this Nixon administration. Most of the people I talked with give me the same story.
Well, I guess that period particularly, that last
so.
Watergate period, yeah.
Not because there was anything that you were trying to hide, but because you were having to move at such a rapid pace and things were developing so quickly, you didn't have time to make memos.
That's right. Now, although it still seems to me there was a terrible flow of paperwork during that period, but a lot of that is... Of course, the personnel office, OMB, and the domestic council can just keep you engulfed in paperwork now without any trouble at all.
Were you doing much in the way of public speaking?
Not in terms of orating, no. In fact, the only speech I guess I made during that period publicly was a speech to the Republican National Committee meeting here in Washington. And I really don't remember when that was, but I suspect it was in April. Probably April, March, April, or May of that period. And that was the only formal speech that I gave. I did a lot of one-on-ones on the lawn. I did a number of briefings in Ken Clausen's Cocktails with Clausen operation. And I did a lot of telephone and interviews, commentary, that sort of thing. But I was not doing public appearances.
You've mentioned your contacts with Capitol Hill, your contacts within the White House complex. Were your contacts with the departments and agencies, for the most part, let's say, limited to the regulatory agencies?
Yes, pretty much. Almost entirely, with the exception of the OEO thing, which I don't really think of as a regulatory agency. I did deal with that when we, when we fired Alvin Arnett as the director. I don't quite know how I got tapped for that job, but I did, and so I had some contact there. And when I talk about contact with the agencies, basically what I'm talking about is contact with the chairman of the various regulatory agencies. And I'm pretty bland contacts at that, in the sense that I would listen to their complaints about their personnel problems, and they would listen to my reaction or suggestion concerning appointments. And I guess one of the things that probably broke down worse toward the end of the Nixon administration than anything else was the appointment process. It was beginning to break down badly for the, well, for the simple reason we're becoming so Congress-oriented that if you had two candidates, one of whom was supported by congressmen and wasn't worth a damn, and one who wasn't supported by congressmen but was worth a damn, the one supported by congressmen tended to win those days, simply because, unfortunately, the administration wasn't strong enough to withstand any congressional pressure. So rather than do that, there just tended to develop a certain number of vacancies on these things that we just weren't really able to focus on too much.
How about your contacts with the Republican Party, let's say perhaps the committee as well as throughout the country?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that also was one of my assigned tasks from the president, was to be the liaison with the National Committee. And during this period, I suppose I spent as much time with George Bush as any single individual that I dealt with.
Now, would that have been just to assist him in the administration of the RNC?
No, not at all. I had nothing. Had no interest in the administration of the RNC. We were in the public relations business at this time. But George was one of our spokesmen. George was clearly one who was always asked for comment on the latest development in Watergate. He was a contact point, not only with members of the committee, but with members of Congress to a good extent. He has a tremendous rapport with the congressmen, having served up there. He still uses the gym and things like that. And besides, he's just an awfully bright, able guy, and was a source of information. And when I met with the president, it was often in, with George and Ann Armstrong. Ann and I worked very closely together during this period, kind of working two sides of the same street often, because I am a former chairman of the National Committee, and she's a former vice chairman, so we both have some interest there. And George would come down here often. He was involved in the personnel process, of course. He was also involved to a certain extent in the speech-making process. So I did spend an awful lot of time with George. I'd known him before he became chairman, but I got to know him before I came down here and before he became chairman. I met him, I think, in 64 when he was running in Texas.
Were your contacts then with the Republican Party nationwide channeled through the RNC or?
No, direct.
Right. Were there very many of them?
Not a hell of a lot. On the trips, like the Michigan trip, the Arizona trip, Mississippi trip, there was quite a bit of contact. And I ended up doing all the stiff arming on these trips of, you know, who you wanted on the plane and who you didn't want on the plane and why, and who's going to be in the receiving line and who isn't, who hands the flowers, and, you know, all of the tacky kind of stuff that has to be done and nobody wants to do. And so I would work all of that out. But I have a number of people that I've known for years that are on the National Committee, and it's not structured. If they got a squawk, they'll call direct. And sometimes you can do something about these things, and more often than not, you can't. A lot of squawks about personnel appointments, statements that people were making, things like that.
When Harry Dent was on the staff here, one of the responsibilities that his office had was to act more or less as the lightning rod for the Republican party people throughout the country. Now, would it be fair to assume that...
That's my job. it's more my job now, the 13th of September, than it was during that period, simply because the National Committee was practically impotent during that period. There just wasn't much going on. And it seemed almost pointless to sit around worrying about who was going to hand the flowers to the president when the walls were cashing down. So the circumstances were such that part of the work just didn't seem to catch on.
Were there any other people or groups outside of the Republican Party that you dealt with, the private interest group type?
Yes, on a kind of an ad hoc basis, every once in a while, through one source or another, I'd get hooked up with somebody who had an interest. And, of course, the communications people, the cable groups, telephone company, people like that would always check off with me if they were going on something that had more than just a local FCC interest. And I maintained my contacts among the communications industry fairly well. And I've been around Washington for a long time, and as a consequence, I know a lot of people who represent companies and groups and individuals. And I would, the function of a Washington representative is to keep probing for entrees, and they don't care about structures. All they want to know is somebody who can get something done, and they don't care how he gets it done or why if it happens. So one of the difficulties in a sort of a utility infielder's job like I have is that there's really nothing that you're not allowed to do, and as a consequence you sort of meet yourself coming around the corner occasionally because you're in areas you don't really want to be in. And yet you don't have your job isn't so well structured that you can say, I'm sorry, that isn't my bag, because as a counselor to the president, theoretically you can do anything that the president wants done.
Would it be fair to say that you did not get involved in any policy matters relating to foreign affairs?
No, that's absolutely correct. I have no expertise, offered nothing on that. I was not involved in that whatsoever. I also attended all the leadership meetings during this period, both bipartisan and Republican. I worked as much as work was going on with Bob Michael, the congressional campaign chairman, and Bill Brock, the senatorial campaign. But there just wasn't much going on. Wasn't much that we were doing.
That takes care of the questions. Is there any area that we failed to cover that you think might be worth touching base on? You've been extremely candid in some of these areas, and I appreciate that, and it certainly will go a long ways to making the record more complete, both for you and for Mr. Nixon.
Well,
and your administration.
I hope so, because somebody's got to write the story someday, I guess, or at least understand it.
Right.
It's going to be very hard to do, too, because the players are already so badly dissipated that, you've got to know anything about that last 6 months. You've got to have St. Clair, and you've got to have Bizarre, and you've got to have Ziegler, and you've got to have Klaus, and you've got to have Hay, Kissinger, a lot of people.
Well, hopefully, with the information you've given us, and Ken Clausen was quite informative in the interview I had with him.
Yeah.
Always keeping in mind, though, that at this point I feel very hesitant to ask any questions that probe too deeply, because I'm sure there's still an awful lot of hurt there, emotion,
yeah.
And I don't think anyone has the perspective on it now that perhaps...
No. And the difficulty is, I pointed up earlier, is that too many people think they know what went on during that period. And really, all they know is a very small worm's eye view of a little bit of what went on. And that includes me. I do not qualify as somebody who knew everything that was going on. I'm not sure anybody did. I'm not sure any single person knew it all, including President Nixon. I'm sure he didn't know much of what was going on at our level.
I'll kick this off now.
Yeah.